Welcome to Unwrap with J-Rap. I am your host, J-Rap. Today I'm going to touch on a little bit of deployments and the differences between, well, some people call them deployments and other people call them not deployments, I guess. I don't know. It's still, we still call them deployments, but they're not combat deployments. So I'm going to make a distinct difference between a combat deployment and a deployment. So regular deployment. Typically, it's just a routine type of training exercise deployment. We go on with coalition forces that we train with, like South Korea, the Republic of, what is it, the Royal Republic of South Korea, I think it's called. We train with them, the ROC Marines, is what we call them. And we train with the Filipino Marines, we call them Philmars. We train with the Japanese Self-Defense Force. They don't call them a military, technically, but they are. They're a defense force because of the treaty that they signed with us after World War II. And we train with a number of other. Australia is another big one that we train with a lot, at least where I've been and who we've trained with. We train with some of the UAE guys from the UAE, obviously, some guys from different countries over there. They come to the States and train. And we go to their countries, some of their countries, and train. Like, we train in Jordan and some other places. So on those training exercises or deployments where we go to those countries, they're not designed to be combative. They're designed for training and training for us. It's training, and for the other countries we're training, it's training for them too. And we learn kind of things from each other. We kind of piggyback off of each other. Obviously, we have a bigger military, a stronger military, and a more lethal military, but we also have gloves and we are forced to wear them. And other countries don't necessarily have those same gloves because of politics. They don't have the restraint that we do. So if something were to happen to their country's military members, they have a different way of approaching things than we would. Most of Europe is along the same lines of us, and Canada, and even Australia. They don't have the same, or they have the same kind of rules of engagement as we do. And then some of the other countries that we work with, they really don't. They don't abide by the same rules that we do, or have the same rules that we do. Even if they do fall under the same type of coalition we do, they definitely have a different set of rules that they follow and they abide by. And in some cases, that's a really good thing for them, and in some cases, it's not. On a non-combative deployment, we would go and do a training exercise, train them with, like, sometimes artillery, sometimes we show them our logistics process, sometimes we go there and we're doing training with their medical people. We don't have medics or whatever you want to call it in the Marine Corps. We have the Navy for that. We have our Navy corpsmen and then the medical officers that we have through the Navy that support us. The Army has medics, and sometimes we do, when we help out with other countries, we bring our entire military as a small group, you know, some of the representation of the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy, along with us and the Marines. So we would go to another country. One kind I can think of off the top of my head was Thailand. We went there with, we had Coast Guard there, we had Air Force, Army, and Navy, and then of course us. We don't have medical officers, so the Navy took that and met with the rest of the branches and helped out in villages and showed the village people kind of what we do in the United States as far as dental practices and medical practices. It was actually pretty awesome to see some of those kids and parents too, but some of the kids over there, just their teeth are completely neglected because, one, they don't have the same type of water we do, and two, they don't have a very good dental hygiene. And it's not because they don't want to. A lot of the times it's because they don't have the available products that we have. And in they also don't have some of the preservatives and everything we have, so there's, that's a good thing for them. But anyway, so I got to see a bit of the interaction with the local people in the villages that we were in Thailand and in the Philippines. We did it as well, a couple other countries. And so we get to kind of oversee and help them out in a way that normally we wouldn't. Normally I wouldn't be supporting the Navy. The Navy would be supporting me. In this case, we support the Navy. So we helped stack boxes for them and kind of, you know, we pretty much helped them that way. Cause there's, I'm not going to be working on anybody's teeth or, you know, any medical type things either. So we pretty much just did the brunt stuff that helped out with the staff that we had there. And then another thing we do is we go over and kind of protect the seas. That's one of the things that the Navy and the Marine Corps together, we kind of do. We are out there and we go out from one country to another and stuff happens between the seas somewhere or in a country between here and there, wherever that is. And we get called up and, you know, we move from where we were going to go to another location because of something that might have happened around the world somewhere in our area. So we have an area of responsibility, I should say the Navy really, has an area of responsibility when we're on ship. And if something were to occur in that radius, or even sometimes outside that radius, they call them up and say, hey, we need your fleet to come here. And we are a part of that fleet being on ship. So we go where they go. And then depending on the situation, we go and help out. So in some cases it could be, for example, we have the Marine Expeditionary Unit. It's quite a few of them. I won't go into detail on those. You can look those up yourself if you'd like. But we have an East Coast, a West Coast, and then we have the overseas one, which was Japan and Hawaii, the Pacific. And if there's a typhoon or flooding or something like that, they are immediately called up almost every time to assist in that. It's full of Marines that are just ready to basically do whatever needs to be done in that situation. So a lot of digging, a lot of moving boxes of food and water and supplies, medical supplies and such. So those are all non-combative deployments and some of the things that happen with them. And then we go do training. We shoot, we do artillery, like I mentioned earlier. With logistics, we'll show them the different ways that we load and unload aircraft, ways that we do external lifts with our helicopters. That was specifically what I did in the Marine Corps, a part of it. We show them how we load and unload ships sometimes. Not as often because they don't have as many ships as we do. Most other forces don't, so it's not as common. And we kind of train with them and show them, you know, the different techniques we have with hand-to-hand combat, what we do differently and what they do differently. And then we have training with how we shoot or how we assess a battle scenario or a combat scenario. And we get feedback from them. And then there, you know, like one of the ones I did was jungle warfare training and jungle survival training. That was my favorite by far of anything that I did in the Marine Corps was the jungle survival. We got dropped off by helicopter in the middle of nowhere in the jungle and in Malaysia actually. And we hiked out to a little area where the Malay Rangers that we had out there, they basically had this little area that was designated for us. We went out there, there's nothing cut down, there's nothing, it's like not prepared for us at all. We get out there, we prepare the area to live in and sleep in for the week or two that we were there. We were told that we weren't gonna have any food brought in for us, that we had to hunt, trap, or kill our own food, which ended up kind of not being true. I wish we could have hunted for our food, but we weren't given that opportunity because of rules of engagement and things like that. They didn't want us running around in the jungles with ammo and shooting at things. So, you know, the things that we're trained to do, we weren't allowed to do, which kind of sucked, to be honest. Anyway, so we got to do that training and live off the land, kind of. So the Malays actually brought us food that they had caught or they had killed or they had, you know, acquired in some way. And some of the food was really weird, just like in Thailand, you know, they had like baked cockroaches, which I would not eat. They had a baked tarantula, another thing I would not eat. But other than that, I ate everything else. I ate crickets, I ate monkey brain, I ate a monitor lizard, I ate a bat, a cooked bat. So a lot of weird things that I ate, but we learned how to survive there just in case something were to happen in the future and we were happened to be in a combat scenario where we don't have any way of getting food. We have no supply line, which really sucked in my position because we usually are the ones providing it. So, administering the provision of. So that would really, really suck if I didn't have food, because that means if I don't have food, then nobody has food. So they were teaching us how to do all these things, and it was really interesting, and got to learn their tactics and ways of doing things. And then for a combative deployment is like going to what you more so have heard of, Iraq, Afghanistan. Let's see, had a couple contingencies go down in the Philippines, had a couple contingencies go down in some other countries. Jordan has some stuff that kind of got hot, but we do training there mostly. Pakistan obviously has stuff going on. Iran has stuff going on. There's things that are, and there is things, believe it or not, that are going on that you don't know that are daily going on. Philippines is a big one right now, and it's been going on since, like, I don't know when, but in 2002, the Abu Sayyaf was there. 2001, 2002, there's about 400 of them. We could have annihilated every one of them at one time very easily, but our rules of engagement were not to do anything about it. So the island or area of Zamboanga was pretty much off limits to U.S. military. So we could do nothing about that. Well, then now I think there's thousands of them, the Abu Sayyaf, I mean, and they aren't just in Zamboanga now. They are all over the Philippines and in other areas too. And they've migrated into Malaysia, and they are a Al-Qaeda based, which is pretty much now ISIS based, but Al-Qaeda based terrorist network. Anyway, so it's totally off. This is why I have to have notes, as I go way off topic. Hopefully you guys are okay with these little side rants, little rabbit trails. So combat deployments like Afghanistan, Iraq, mostly those two are what people think of. So those are deployments we go to depending on what your mission is, depending on what your unit's mission is, and depending on the climate that you're going into and where you're going to be stationed at there will really determine how that deployment plays out. And when in a battle, when or in a conflict or whatever you want to call it. So with Afghanistan, depending on when you went, and Iraq, depending on when you went, if you talk to other military members and you say, oh, I went in this year or that year, they already kind of have an idea how it was, depending on where you were. For example, if you say you were in Fallujah in 04 or 05, they know that life was pretty rough there, and you probably saw a lot of death and destruction. If you were in Afghanistan in the early 2000s or even the early 2010 through 2013 even, you probably saw quite a bit of stuff. If you went into late 2013 and 2014, you might have seen stuff depending on where you were in Afghanistan, but you wouldn't have seen nearly as much as if you'd been there earlier. So that doesn't mean that you won't see anything. I have friends that were on deployment the same time I was in Afghanistan, and they got shot at regularly. So it's not to say that it doesn't happen. It's just depending on where you're at. Now, like I said, depending on where you're at, I was on a flight line where it was attacked the year before. Actually got rocketed the year before while Marines were there, and one of them got launched across the office. He lived, everything was okay, but he got launched across the office that I was literally stationed in. So it is a possibility, but the likelihood is a lot less when I was there. We got rocketed on Father's Day at like 2 o'clock in the morning by some Chinese rockets that the Taliban or whoever had acquired. What they would do is they would get a block of ice and put mortar type rockets together. When the ice melts, the person is already gone by then. It's a very hot climate at that time anyway. The ice melts and then impact happens and the round goes out. So when we go to find whoever it is that was trying to rocket or shoot artillery at us, there's nobody there because the ice block was there instead of a person being there. So that's one of the ways. I mean, it doesn't always work. Sometimes ice doesn't melt fast enough or something. I don't know. But there are ways that it doesn't work so well. And the Chinese rockets that they had were very, like, extremely inaccurate. There was almost no accuracy in there. So they just pretty much shot and hoped that they would hit a target. And they were pretty far off from hitting anyone for the most part. They got near one of the British Royal Marines area. They hit near there, but nobody was killed by the rockets, thankfully. Anyway, so those are kind of the big differences between combat related or combat deployments and then the non-combat deployments. So I've been on quite a few deployments, only one combat deployment, and like I said, mine was not as nearly as bad as many other people's, and then worse than many others. So it just depends on how you look at it. I wasn't in fear every day because I was on a pretty structured base that had pretty good defense set up. So I wasn't too worried. I walked around pretty freely knowing that I wasn't gonna be sniped or you know, shot at by anybody. So I didn't have that thought. There's a couple things that are eerie. You're always a little eerie when you're in another country like that, and the locals work in the laundry facilities or they drive the trash truck, the big garbage truck. That was terrifying to me every time they came by where we live, because I don't know what's in that truck, and I'm hoping that the person that, you know, checked the truck when it came onto the base, that they checked it properly. I don't know. I wasn't at the front gates or whatever, or any of the gates, so I don't know what their procedures were, but I'm hoping that they were good. And they were, and that nothing happened. Or at least nothing happened while I was there. So those are some of the things, you know, you can't take the element of fear out of any deployment when you're over there, but it's not like I was terrified every day. I definitely was not. And then there's other deployments where I have friends that every day was terrifying to them because they didn't know if the next day was going to be their last, or if that day was going to be their last, I should say, because they weren't in an area where they were protected by anything but the truck that they drove out on that's armored. But we've seen how that works when they run over, you know, IEDs and stuff. So it is a possibility to get hit by a rocket or to get shot and if you're not in the vehicle at the time. So like I said, I didn't really have to live that life in Afghanistan. That wasn't something I had. I've only been shot at once, and it was not in Afghanistan. It's a feeling that only another person that's been shot at can understand, and a person who's been shot at and is allowed to shoot back, I can't speak on that because we weren't allowed to. So for me, it was even scarier because it was like, well, that's awesome. Got shot at, not allowed to shoot back because of rules of engagement. That's awesome. Rules of engagement, they're so awesome. That's the gloves I was talking about. We had gloves on. So we pretty much had to hope not to get shot at again. For those of you listening to this that have been in combat, have been shot at and able to shoot back, like I said, I can't speak to that. But I wish I could have, because that would have been nice to know that when somebody shot at me that I could shoot back. But anyway, my point was that it's if you've never been shot at, there's nothing that compares to that, adrenaline-wise. Absolutely nothing. I have a buddy, really a good buddy of mine that was on recruiting duty with me, that was an infantryman in the Marine Corps, a rifleman. And when we were on recruiting duty and it got really tough sometimes and very stressful, he actually said, I would rather be getting shot at right now. And I couldn't understand that, because there's no level of stress in an office or in some type of working environment that would make me feel like I'd rather be getting shot at. So I had to ask him why, and he said, because in a situation where I get shot at, I can shoot back. All I kept thinking was, well, that wasn't my experience, but I understand his position. And yes, he does get the shoot back in almost every time. So his rules of engagement from where he was probably almost always in a case where if somebody shoots at you, you can shoot back, being an infantryman. So all that to say that it's an experience that you can't, how do I say this? You cannot copy that experience by doing something that's an adrenaline rush. Like, I mean, I don't have a desire to ride a motorcycle at 180 miles an hour, but some people do. And most of those people are people that have been in extreme situations where they've had their life threatened multiple times in one day. So those type of people, they have to do something to kind of get that adrenaline rush. And I understand that, but I don't have that need or void in my life where I need to go chase that thrill. But I completely can understand where they're coming from on that. Anyway, another rabbit trail there. So basically, the difference between a combat deployment and a regular non-combat deployment, again, is one is typically intended on training and going out and doing some type of training with another country or our own country, but in another country. Sometimes we don't utilize their military at all. We just do the training in their country because of the terrain or the ability to do something there that we can't do. For example, in Hawaii, you can't shoot artillery. And we have batteries there. Those are the people that shoot artillery. And they aren't allowed to shoot artillery in Hawaii. So they have to go to the United States somewhere else, continental US, or because they're technically attached to the Pacific 3rd Marine Division, basically the guys in Japan, Okinawa mostly, they end up going to Japan or Korea, mostly Mount Fuji, to shoot artillery. So imagine being an artilleryman stationed in Hawaii and you can't do your job. I mean, you can do all the training that leads up to actually pulling the cord, launching artillery shells, but you can't actually shoot it. That would suck. I have to say that would suck terribly. So when they get to go, and I have gone with them to Mount Fuji, and you get to shoot off artillery, those guys mean business. They're there to do it, and they're not gonna stop. And they're so high intensity because they don't get to do it often, being stationed in Hawaii. So I can't even imagine being stationed in a place and not being able to do my job at all, and then finally being able to do it, and it's only for 2 days that I get to do it. So I had to ask them if I could join in on, you know, pulling the cord or whatever. They let me, but they really hesitated, because if you mess it up, you just waste it a round, and they don't get a whole lot of rounds. So basically I would have been taking their time from them. But because I was the one that was helping them to get their artillery and their artillery shells from point A to point B, they were less reluctant to let me. So they helped me out, showed me how to do it and everything, and it worked. It's awesome. It's a pretty cool experience. You can actually see the shell leaving the barrel and in the air, which is pretty cool. Not for very long. It disappears very quickly, but you can see it, that which is pretty cool. You can't do that with a bullet, so it was pretty awesome to see. And those rounds are seriously heavy, and I wouldn't want to do that job personally. But anyway, again, another rabbit trail. So they go on deployments sometimes just to go to another country to be able to do their own job and experience what they joined the Marine Corps to do, or at least what their MOS is, their military occupational specialty, and actually train. So they get to finally go out there and do what they are supposed to do, so that they know how to do what they're supposed to do when the time comes. Most other places they can do that. Like when I was in 29 Palms, they did artillery all the time. And there's impact areas where you're not even allowed to go into because there's unexploded stuff out, ordnance out there, unexploded things. And then there's also artillery or other types of missiles, rockets, artillery. What's the other one I'm thinking? Mortars, things like that, that are constantly going on. So anyway, next episode, I will go into depth a little bit about my deployments and where I went and what I did, so that you guys have a little bit of an understanding of what I did do and what goes on in a non-combat deployment, because those are the majority of mine. And then I'll talk about a little bit about Afghanistan and some of the stuff that goes on there from my point of view, not from other people's point of view, because I want to speak on my own point of view. Hope you guys had a good time listening, and I hope that you guys are around and listening to the next episode that comes out.